Welcome to the Full of Money audio commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 6:48 Greenwich Mean Time. Today is February 11th, and of course, today being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio for the various different asset classes. First, let's have a review of what's been happening this week. The pattern over the last few months, and particularly since November, has been the outperformance of Wall Street in Europe relative to Asia and Latin America, and that trend has picked up pace somewhat this week. As we are a couple of hours away from the close on Wall Street, the Dow Jones is finishing the week above 12,000, the S&P is still above 1,300, and in Europe, the FTSE is above 6,000, the DAX is above 7,000, the IBEX is above 10,000. So we've seen that a number of these larger cap markets have done really quite well over the last couple of weeks, in particular, but particularly over the last few months since November, really. And that contrasts really quite sharply with what happened in Asia this week, because the Taiwanese market opened up following the Spring Festival holiday and has fallen really quite abruptly over the last 3 days. Korea has also been really quite weak. The Indian market has been leading on the downside and had an upside key reversal in here today. So not exactly the time to be writing this market off. Now, of course, an upside key reversal isn't going to be game, set, and match for this really quite abrupt decline, but additional follow through this week and a break of the progression of lower rally highs would certainly add additional evidence that this market has found support beyond the short term. Elsewhere in Asia, the Thai, Philippine, Singapore markets were also weak in here. The Indonesian market, which has been a leader, has found support in the region of the 200-day moving average and continues to range around that area. And in Latin America, the Brazilian market pulled back really quite sharply in the early part of this week. It's a bit steadier in here today, but it's been ranging below the 74,000 level for the better part of 18 months. And it really does need to get above that to indicate that this isn't a developing Type 3 top. The Argentinian market has also been one of the better performers on the continent, but it's looking tired, it's lost momentum, it pulled back rather sharply yesterday, and it's really quite overextended relative to its 200-day moving average. If we look at some of the commodity markets, the precious metals had a good early part of the week and have finished out the week a little bit softer, particularly platinum. The industrial metal complex remains relatively steady. The copper market is continuing to hold around this $4.50 area, and that translates to about $10,000 on the LME contract. In the agricultural commodities, corn is up 3 in here today. Soybeans is a little bit softer, and wheat is relatively unchanged. But the degree of commonality that's evident right across the food commodities and indeed agricultural commodities generally is really quite impressive. If one goes to the chart library and looks at the soft commodities sector, then you will see that there's a large number of these markets are pushing on to hit new recovery highs, or they're reasserting their medium-term uptrends. And that's really in no small part due to the fact that 2010 and already in 2011 has been a pretty poor year for crops. David mentioned in last night's audio that he'd received a call from John McIntosh talking about the white corn crop having been severely damaged in Mexico. So that's likely to put additional upward pressure, and it's just another example of another major agricultural area where the yields are coming in well below expectations. So that is an opportunity and also a risk, because higher food prices are stoking inflationary pressures. And back in 2008, you had food prices and oil prices rallying impressively and simultaneously, and they led to a really quite a deep recession. You do not have energy prices rallying in the same fashion this time around as you do with food prices. And this food inflation being stoked by La Nina is something that's probably going to run for at least the short term. And none of these agricultural commodities have really given us any convincing indication that they have hit medium-term peaks, and provided they remain consistent and their progressions of higher reaction lows remain intact, we can continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. However, when we look at so many of these commodities, particularly in the agricultural sector, and we look at some of the stock market indices, such as on Wall Street or in Europe, they all share a common characteristic of becoming increasingly overextended relative to their 200-day moving averages. And in the short term, that performance is really very, very impressive. However, over the medium term, when something becomes so violently overextended relative to its 200-day moving average, and cotton is a very good example of something that has become radically overextended, then the likelihood of a reversion towards the mean is gathering pace. So this isn't a time to become increasingly bullish, but rather to be aware to the fact that accelerations are trend endings, but of undetermined duration. So when we see markets that are accelerating away from a trend mean, such as the 200-day moving average, then that's an indication that we're getting increasingly close to the next significant peak. And particularly for leveraged traders, that's important information to factor into one's position sizing. The other side of that is that when one wants to short something that has become so radically overextended, then one waits for the first clear downward dynamic. That's the probably the lowest risk way of shorting into a market that's accelerating higher. We only see some acceleration in the agricultural commodities. There's certainly no acceleration in on the Dow or the S&P or even the Nasdaq, but they are becoming overextended, and breaks of progressions of higher reaction lows are likely to indicate that we're moving into another corrective phase within what is a cyclical bull market. This was also a week in which we saw US Treasuries breaking down, I think on Monday, and rallying somewhat into the end of the week. And the US dollar, which a number of people had been writing off at back at the beginning of January, has firmed somewhat into the end of the week, particularly against the euro, but also against commodity currencies. And against the Australian dollar, it's back to parity. Against the Canadian dollar, it's coming back up towards parity. And against some of those currencies, particularly in Asia, such as the Singapore dollar or the Taiwan dollar or the Korean won, then the US dollar has rallied really quite emphatically. So we are starting to see that foreign investor flows are beginning to come out of Asia, and they are being pushed back into Wall Street. But what we are now also seeing is that in the financial media is that people are beginning to brag about their overweight position on Wall Street and how they've already pulled their money out of Asia in particular. And usually that tells people more what they've already done rather than what they're about to do. And given the fact that you have this acceptance that, or I suppose a better word would be that people really do believe that Wall Street is going to be the best performer in 2011, and that this is going to be a very quiet year indeed for the Asian markets, and they've positioned their portfolios accordingly. But we're seeing a number of these markets coming back to areas of potential support. India, which has led on the downside, had an upside Q reversal in here today. And we're seeing that a number of developed markets have become really quite overextended relative to their 200-day moving averages. So the rotation that we commented on way back in November, and really does feel like a long time ago now, could be getting close to having run its course. We don't have any evidence of that just yet, but if we do start to see some of these Asian markets and Latin American markets beginning to find support in the region of their 200-day moving averages or somewhere around there, and downward dynamics starting to creep in on some of those better performing indices so far this year, such as the S&P or the DAX, then we might be starting to see a rotation back the other way. And there isn't anybody talking about that right now because everyone has already positioned themselves for the USA and potentially Europe to outperform for the rest of the year, and that's a lot of what you're hearing in the financial media. But as I said, that really tells us what they've already done, not exactly what's going to happen. If we take a step back and look at the bigger picture, we're in the middle of the greatest urbanization in history. There is a phenomenal amount of commentary on whether China is a huge bubble and going to go bust, or whether it's going to be the next really big superpower. And there's probably a degree of truth in both of those arguments. There is no doubt that property prices, particularly in China's big cities, have gone up to an extent where they have become a problem, and affordability has seldom been so low. So we've seen the Chinese government raising reserve requirements, they're raising interest rates to combat inflation, they've put in a number of measures to target the housing market, and that does appear to be working. The pace at which the property prices are rising has moderated. So in one regard, that is certainly a positive. Over the long term, China has just gone through 20 years where it's had a phenomenal industrialization, and it's lifted in the region of 500 million people out of poverty. It still has a ways to go in terms of eliminating abject poverty, particularly in the countryside, but that trend of urbanization is well entrenched at this point. But China is certainly the country that makes the most headlines, but certainly not the only country that has a big population and is in need of quite a lot of urbanization over the medium term. India is really only just beginning to get its act together. And again, in India, where people have lost confidence somewhat over the last couple of months in India's ability to manage its own affairs, and particularly with the impact of food price inflation. But India's jewels are its private sector, and it's got enviable economic growth. The food price inflation is not an unmanageable problem, and the very fact that it has become a problem probably makes the likelihood that there's going to be a more substantial solution this time around that bit more likely. So you have urbanization in China, in India, in much of the Asian region, and particularly in Indonesia, but also in Latin America with Brazil, and in the Middle East if we take it as one whole region. So the big theme, or the probably the most important statistic, is that economic growth in the world's major population centers is outpacing population growth. That's raising literally hundreds of millions of people out of subsistence living and into the middle classes, and it's creating an increase in per capita demand for just about everything. That is now being felt most acutely in the food sector, because previously, when supply went down, you had starvation. And while you're starting to get food riots right now, part of the problem with the food markets is that you've had a minor problem with supply, but the inventories of foods have been decreasing for a number of years because consumption has gone up. Middle class people cannot only, there aren't just more of them, but they can afford to eat well and eat more. So the demand component of the global food market has risen, and it is now a supply inelasticity problem because significant global joined up thinking is going to be required to make sure that the global population is fed. And this current, or the what is potentially turning into a food crisis, will, I think, probably help to accelerate that. It will also help to accelerate regulatory impacts on the food commodities themselves. You're already talking, or the CFTC are already doing a 6-month review of the impact of speculation, and there is also the potential that margin requirements are going to start going up in the pretty near future, particularly when you see that corn is above $7, soybeans above $14, and wheat above $8. So these commodities have rallied really very impressively over the last month. They look quite likely to take out their 2008 peaks. And back in 2008, the margin requirements getting hiked up was one of the reasons that, or one of the catalysts that punctured the little bubble that had been developing. So that regulatory arbitrage is certainly something to keep an eye on. But the increase in per capita demand for commodities isn't confined to foods, but it extends to just about all industrial commodities, and including energy. We've written quite a bit this week about natural gas, because natural gas stands outside the energy complex's commonality. Oil has risen quite a bit over the last few months, and it's established itself above $80. It's not, it was last week, I think it was closer to 90, and it's finishing out this week closer to 85. Higher oil prices have been a tailwind for other energy commodities. So, coal and uranium, heating oil and gasoline have all reasserted medium-term uptrends. The higher oil prices have also helped to stoke interest in renewables such as wind and solar. Those industries are increasingly being dominated by the Chinese, where China is the Saudi Arabia of rare earths, in the words of Deng Xiaoping, and they have manufacturing capacity and economies of scale and access to low-cost rare earths that they have a significant competitive advantage in creating wind turbines. They've gone heavily into solar, and all of those green jobs that were going to be created by advocating renewable energy, they've been created all right, but they've been created in China. So the renewable sector certainly doesn't perform very well when energy prices are low, but it doesn't perform very well either on creating energy security or reliable jobs for the amount of subsidy that needs to go in to support these industries. And natural gas really is standing out because it's today it's below $4, and it's deteriorated at the same time that other energy commodities have been advancing. Unconventional natural gas, such as shale gas, tight gas, or sand gas, the technology for exploiting it has been developed in the USA, and the USA has vast reserves of this commodity. So not only is natural gas abundant, cheap, and domestic to the USA, but there's lots and lots of it around. And that's a major game changer for the energy sector. The fact that we're now starting to see stories that the horizontal drilling and hydraulic fracturing that has allowed unconventional gas to be brought to the surface is now also being employed in shale oil, suggests that that's new technology that is going to head off the worst estimations of peak oil. So we're probably not going to have peak oil. That's good news for stock markets. That's good news for the global economy. And that's good news for in just about every regard. We're going to have a major bull market in just about anything that can benefit from lower energy prices. And that also is good news for the global economy, because with an expanding middle class, demand for energy in particular is going to be a dominant theme for a considerable period of time. When we look at the major theme that's dominating markets, it's quite easy to see that you have progressing and regressing markets. You have those markets that are running current account surpluses, that have control of their fiscal policies, that are attempting to control their inflationary pressures, that are less leveraged in terms of debt, that have a demographic, or they're hitting their demographic sweet spots. And they're easily compared with those markets that have a poor fiscal condition, have high debt levels, are in an aging profile in their demographics, and have much slower economic growth. So we don't believe that it is correct any longer to talk about the emerging markets and the developed markets, but it's more like progressing and regressing. And the progressing markets are largely in Asia and Latin America, and the regressing markets are predominantly in Europe and in the USA. And the commodity-led markets are somewhere in between, because on the one hand, they have incredible natural wealth in terms of their commodities, and the per capita demand for commodities remains on an upward trajectory, so they're likely to do very well over the medium term. But on the other hand, Australia and Canada in particular have got pretty slow growth rates in their domestic economies. And that's a rather delicate balance that needs to be found for those particular countries. But their stock markets suggest that that investor interest is continuing to give them the benefit of the doubt. And that's likely to remain the case for at least the medium term. When we look at the difference between the progressing and the regressing markets, it sets up two major themes, because one can invest in directly into the stock markets of those countries that are most likely to do best, or we can invest in their currencies, which have been outperforming and are likely on a trajectory of appreciation, particularly versus the currencies of regressing countries. We can invest in the companies that are most likely to benefit from growth in the global economy, and growth continues to be led by Asia and Latin America. So that all fits into one separate theme. The other side of it is that you have regressing markets, where their currencies are coming under pressure, where governments have taken on a huge amount of debt, where yields have been falling for nearly 30 years, and perhaps longer in some countries. And When you come to the end of any major market event, and every bull market ends with a massive increase in supply, and we've seen a massive increase in supply of government bonds, corporate bonds, and personal indebtedness, particularly in regressing countries. Now, a number of those companies are in pretty sound financial situations and are taking advantage of remarkably low yields that they're probably never going to see again. But the governments of Europe and in the USA don't have the same luxury. They have to issue these bonds, and they're issuing them at pretty miserable yields. And there has been quite a penchant for investing or for a quantitative easing. Quantitative easing isn't going to be a problem, an inflationary problem in the short term, because the velocity of money supply collapsed during 2008. They're not going to be worried about inflationary pressures until the velocity of money picks back up, and even then, they're likely to leave a lot of that money supply in the system until they're absolutely sure that the trajectory of money supply is back on an even track. And it's at that point that inflation could quite easily become a problem. So there's a strong likelihood that US Treasury yields have bottomed. That means that the prices have topped out, and that's likely to be a secular theme. So in regressing markets, short government bonds is likely to be a theme that is going to dominate for really quite a long time. And gold has often been seen as a hedge against both inflation and deflation. And inflation is likely to be a much more likely scenario. So gold has been rallying for the last 10 years, and it's been consolidating recently in the region of its 200-day moving average, and it's currently sitting around $1,360. This has been a medium-term pullback. It's rallied in the short term, but in the long term, there hasn't really been anything that has occurred to question potential for this to remain within its secular bull market. It's been going upwards for 10 years, and everyone now pretty much accepts that gold is in a bull market. And that leaves, if we go through the psychological perception stages of a bull market, at the beginning you have disbelief. Nobody believed in 2001 that gold would go from $250 to $300 to over $1,300 in less than 10 years. And that was the beginning of the bull market. And now we've gone through acceptance. Everyone accepts right now that gold is in a bull market, and that leaves the third psychological perception stage, which is euphoria. And in gold's case, that would be gold fever. Now, we're nowhere near that right now. There's definitely been a greater investment case for owning precious metals, and a lot more people have invested in precious metals, and demand, particularly for gold coins, has exploded over the last few years. But on an institutional level, the ownership of gold remains comparatively low, and we could potentially go into an accelerated phase. But we also need to bear in mind that if that were to occur, the inflationary problems that would come with it would not be trivial, and it would also be an ending. If we were to see gold fever, it would likely also coincide with significantly higher government bond yields, and would probably put up or downward pressure on some of the stock markets, and particularly those that are most prone to inflationary pressures. So we have progressing and regressing markets, and investment themes that benefit from both of those major themes. But the major bull market theme that is likely to dominate for decades to come is the greatest urbanization in history. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, but wish all the best to all of you.